This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, this is Tanya Plibersek. You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9.
Indeed, you are listening to Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Thanks, Paul, for the news. I'm Macca. We have a new guest in the studio, Navina. Would you like to introduce them?
It's my pleasure to welcome to the studio Dr. Adam Karp. Welcome to Saturday Magazine.
Hi, good to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good, that's good. We saw, you know, some sad news, Adam, in the passing of Phil Carswell.
Yes.
And what we would like to talk about this morning is what he did and the legacy and how important his life was to our community, but particularly in the HIV/AIDS sector. He stood up, he shouted, he advocated, he achieved.
He did all those things.
Yeah.
He played an absolutely, absolutely central leadership role when what was then called the AIDS virus, even before it was called HIV or the gay plague, it was called all sorts of terrible things. When news of that first arrived, Phil was very active in the Also Foundation. They called a meeting, as you may remember, at the Royal Dental Hospital. We had a panel of doctors. Following that, there was then another meeting in the dining room at the Laird Hotel, which formed the Victorian AIDS Action Committee. And that committee was basically just everyone who put their hand up.
Yeah.
The only person that everyone on the committee knew was Phil Carswell, because he had such a wide sphere of activity. He was a teacher, he was a trade unionist, he was a member of the Communist Party at one time, but he was also very socially active. All the dance venues knew him, all the Leathermen and clones all knew him. And so he was the only person in the room that everybody knew, and he became the convener. And then in the following year, he became the first president of the Victorian AIDS Council. And he played an absolutely central role. He and Lex Watson from Sydney were drafted in to be our representatives with the National Advisory Committee on AIDS, with Ida Buttrose, and he dealt with David Pennington and Ian Gust and the medical authorities. And he discovered, perhaps to his surprise, that he had enormous leadership ability. He had a great ability to work with people, to smooth over differences. On that initial committee, we had five different political parties that people belonged to. Phil was able to get on with everybody. And during those really desperate, dark times, I don't know how many of your listeners now remember 1983, 1984, before we had antibody tests, before anybody knew who was infected and who was not, who was going to die and who was not. It was a truly terrifying time. And Phil had a leadership style that was always optimistic, was always forward-looking, was always full of energy and enthusiasm. Let's get together. We can beat this thing. And he made, although he always thought he was not a great public speaker, in fact, he was.
He was,
and if you, I don't know, more people will have heard his speech at the Ruby Red Bull last year, which you can find online. Yeah. Cal Hawke has it. Some extracts from it at his show just this week. He was, in fact, an extremely effective public speaker because he spoke directly what he was feeling. He could read an audience. He knew what their fears and anxieties were, and he could address them directly. So he played an absolutely central role during those early years. And, of course, he and the late Ian Goller were the first openly gay men to be employed by a state health department to work on AIDS. Which, again, he played an important educational role with the public servants, with the public health people. He said, no, this is not the way we're going to do this. You have to work with the community.
Yeah.
You can't treat us as though...
You can't impose.
You can't. This is not like a 19th century outbreak of plague where you quarantine everybody and you close shops and you all those kinds of traditional public health things. This is different. This is a community that knows what it wants. At that point, we knew more about AIDS than the doctors did.
Yes.
And some of them acknowledged that. So his role at that time was absolutely central. And then, of course, later he moved to Queensland, where he did basically the same work over again with the Queensland health system and worked for 20 years in preventive health, not just on HIV, but a whole range of things in Queensland, until he was summarily sacked by Campbell Newman. But he continued to be an advisor right up until the last few weeks. He was still a member of several advisory committees for in the Queensland health system as a health advocate, because he'd had a kidney transplant. He knew the hospital system, both as an advocate but also as a patient.
Yes.
And its weaknesses in dealing with people with chronic illness and age-related problems, age-related problems. So he was active right to the end. So his activist career spanned 50 years in a whole range of activities.
A life well-lived and a life that contributed so much to our community.
And even before the advent of HIV, yes. He was active in the group, that the Gay Teachers and Students group, yes. That produced Young, Gay and Proud, which was an absolutely pioneering publication for young people coming out as gay or lesbian, the first in the world, and is still being reprinted in the US.
Exactly.
Because it was never copyrighted. And because it was anonymous, it was published anonymously, so yes. It wasn't copyright. Yeah. So it's been endlessly pirated, which is fine. Yeah. If it gets to people, all the better. So that was even before, when Phil was a school teacher and a trade unionist. He was editor of the Teachers Union Journal. He was active in a whole range of areas that a lot of people didn't realise, the different parts of his life that overlapped, or sometimes they were kept separate.
Phil saved lives.
He certainly did.
Hundreds, if not thousands. Yeah.
The Safe Sex campaign that the Victorian AIDS Council, which wasn't entirely Phil, obviously, there were lots of other people, but he was the spearhead of it. He was the one who went to health ministers and said, here is a brochure about fisting, which we have to produce. And the minister said, I can't approve that.
Yes.
And Phil would say, we'll do it. You just sign the checks. And that worked. We saved governments from the embarrassment and the difficulty of doing things they didn't want to do and didn't know how to do.
Yeah, give them someone to blame.
Yes, and the minister could have said, I didn't have anything to do with this. Those naughty AIDS Council people did that. But the work got done.
Yeah.
And it was Phil that was able to cross that bridge and talk to ministers, talk to health bureaucrats, talk to professors of medicine in a way that really did. I don't know if you saw, there was a very nice tribute from Professor Ian Gust.
There was.
Who was... Yeah. The head of the AIDS Task Force after David Pennington, who worked very closely with Phil and acknowledged his leadership, that both he and Pennington learned a lot, not just from Phil, but particularly from Phil, because he was the one who went to those meetings and argued with them and persuaded them.
Yeah.
And sometimes he lost, sometimes he won, but he was always in there at the front line.
The gay and liberation movement, which Phil was such an important part of, looked very different now. It looked very different then, and we have so much to be thankful for now. What reflections do you think younger people and people who are involved in advocacy, whether it's across health or unions or education, could look to Phil and take some lessons?
Well, Phil came out very young. He was involved in organising the first National Gay Activists Conference at Melbourne Uni in 1975 when he was 22. And he was completely fearless. He would go on TV, he would do it. That kind of activism we still need.
Yeah.
We still need people who are willing to run those kinds of risks. Now, the risks are different now to what they were in the early 80s, but obviously there are still risks. And dangers involved in being a high-profile activist, particularly at the moment when political extremism is rearing its ugly head again, as we saw during COVID. So I think the lesson is that if you're willing to stick your neck out, you can win great victories. The campaign for law reform, the basic decriminalisation campaign, which someone like Jamie Gardner was central in. Phil was involved, but he wasn't the leader of that. But you can win those victories. The issues are different now. The current generation of young queer people obviously have different fights to fight. But the basic political lesson is the same. You have to get in there and wage those fights. We saw that with the marriage equality campaign,
absolutely,
which involved a whole new generation of young activists on an issue that was important to them. I was a bit sceptical about it, I must say, but our generation of activists didn't think much of marriage. But that was the issue they chose to fight, and it was a terrific campaign, and they won.
We never thought, Adam, and... that we would ever get it. And I remember, and I'm not going to drop you in it too much, but a previous member for the seat in where we sit here, Michael Danby, was a late passenger on the bus for marriage equality.
Well, politicians obviously have to judge risks and benefits.
Yeah.
That electorate, as you know, is a very diverse electorate.
Yes.
It has a radical end and a conservative end.
It does.
And Michael counted some heads and eventually came across on that issue.
Yes, and he actually made the announcement on Saturday Magazine. Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask Adam, how would you remember, what would you say to remember Phil, to people that perhaps aren't familiar with his work, that decades of advocacy and standing up. How would you like him to be remembered?
Oh, well, I mean, he was one of my closest friends. Obviously, at a purely personal level, yes. I loved him dearly, as did many, many people, as you can see from the tributes on Facebook and elsewhere that have been paid to him. He was an immensely lovable guy. I'm very sorry for Ian, his husband, yes. Who's, I'm sure, I know, because I've spoken to him, completely bereft at yes. losing Phil after 40 years. After they got married in New York on Stonewall Day in yes. 2013. But he leaves a very large hole in many people's lives. He was made a life member of his union in Queensland. He was a close friend of Stephen Miles, who's now the Premier of Queensland. Yeah. He had an enormously wide circle of influence. I will simply remember him mostly as, you know, my good friend. We went through a great deal together. He was one of the first people I came out to when I was 20, I think, 21. And it's still hard to grasp that he's not there anymore. You know, when you lose a lifelong friend at 70,
yeah, yeah.
It reminds you of your own mortality, obviously. But it also leaves a gap of regular conversations. We had a Zoom group of old VAC people, and suddenly Phil's not going to be there anymore. Yeah. And that's really is very sad. But he deserves to be remembered. As an extremely articulate, effective, courageous, persuasive leader who, as you said before, led our community and saved untold numbers of lives through the intervention that we were able to make at that period of crisis.
A truly great Australian.
Yes, he was.
And, you know, I'm very sad, for Ian. I'm very sad for everyone that knew Phil, but I'm also very sad for our community because we have lost a warrior who fought and won so many battles at a huge cost, but he never gave up.
No, that's true. If people would like to go to your radio station's website,
yes.
To Cal Hawke's show from Wednesday, well, Thursday?
Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah. There's a long extract from two of Phil's speeches that you can listen to, yeah. which gives you some idea of his speaking style and of his personality and of the things he did. He's got a book, a memoir, which is at the moment being considered by Melbourne University Press. We sincerely hope that it actually gets published because it will be a unique account of leadership, how this leadership role was thrust upon him. He didn't ask for it. It just literally almost landed in his lap. He was suddenly found himself having to save a community from disaster.
Yeah.
And that's what that's what's put in that book. And there are other great books, David Menadue's book, David Bradford's book.
Yeah.
But Phil's is unique because it's an account of leadership and how you cope with leadership when you didn't set out to be a leader. Lex Watson could have written a similar book about Sydney, but sadly he didn't. So this is going to be an absolutely unique account.
One final question, completely off subject, Adam. Federal government, religious freedom legislation. Are they gutless?
Well, it's a very tricky one, this, isn't it? Labor promised, and Scott Morrison also promised, legislation to protect students against discrimination.
Yes.
There seems to be a cross-party consensus about that bit. But I don't think Peter Dutton does consensus, as we saw during the Voice referendum.
Yep.
What he wants is a political win. The other issue is teachers, though. That's a much more complicated issue because we do have an education system in this country that allows religious organisations to run their own schools according to their own values. You have to balance that and the right of parents to send their kids to whatever kind of school they want against the rights of teachers as employees not to be unfairly discriminated against. I don't claim to know what the answer, how you square that circle is. It's been in front of Mark Dreyfus, the Attorney General, now for 2 years. We still haven't seen what his proposed solution to that problem is. But the commitment that the government made at the election was that they would legislate to protect students, they would legislate to protect teachers against discrimination while respecting the rights of parents and schools to teach according to their their beliefs, their faith. So Catholic schools, Islamic schools, Orthodox Jewish schools.
Whatever, yeah.
But how you resolve that contradiction, I don't know what the answer is. And obviously it's proving very difficult for the government to frame a bill that has any chance of passing, which is why Albanese has been talking to Dutton to try to get an agreement. Now, I don't think he's going to get one, but I think it's worth the effort trying. So we'll just have to see what comes out the other end of the pipe.
Perhaps we should channel Phil, if you believe in something, you need to stand up and fight for it. And, you know, I do respect, and I've always respected, the views and the beliefs of people of faith. What I don't respect is my taxes being used to fund discriminatory practices in education. If they want to discriminate, and they shouldn't, let's say no federal or state funding to a school that acts those practices. Now, people will go, oh, you can't do that. Why not?
Well,
why not?
I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but
another minute.
All right. Gough Whitlam, more than 50 years ago, during the debate about state aid to non-government schools, said, if it's a principle that parents have the right to educate their children according to their own beliefs, that cannot be a privilege based on wealth, whether you can afford to send your kids to Scotch or to Genetzano and everyone else. So that was why he argued that all non-government schools should get government funding on a needs basis. That was why he set up the Schools Commission, not discriminating against what type of school it was. That means we've had for 50 years more a policy of funding all schools on the basis of educational need, not on the basis of their beliefs or ideology. Now, how you square that with anti-discrimination law is obviously the guts of this problem. I don't think it's reasonable to say if the Catholics or the Muslims or the Orthodox Jews want to run their schools the way, then they should do it from their own resources, because that returns it to being a class privilege. The wealthy can send their kids to exclusive private schools where they can pay the fees, and other people can't.
They get the same amount per head that the public system gets. That's it. I'm not paying taxes to see my community discriminated against. If they think that's a good policy, good on them. But they're gutless. They're weak. And they're dog whistling with a mangy dog.
I think we've used our minute.
Yes. You are on Saturday Magazine with Macca and Nepina. We just had an incredible tribute to the warrior.
Thanks, Adam.
Phil Caswell.
I'm sorry to
with
pull
Dr.
you.
Adam
always,
Carr.
Always a pleasure, and I know Macca will always have a good argument about
something. Oh, yeah. Look, you know, the problem with Adam and I is we're both right.
Always.
It is an extremely difficult conundrum to solve.
Yeah.
You've got two sets of rights you're trying to balance against each other. And I, as I say, I don't know what the answer is. I don't think you do either, really.
No, but I know that the answer isn't what's happening now.
Okay.
So thank you, Adam.
Pleasure.
Always
a pleasure.
And believe me, if I knew the answer,
he'll tell you.
I couldn't make money out of it, but I reckon it'd be a great to know the answer. Thank you so much, Adam.
Pleasure. Anytime.
You are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Our next guest is Andrew State, CEO of the Pinnacle Foundation. We're going to have a chat about their work and what they do and what's on the horizon. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.